Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, Griefsters. Thank you so much for choosing to listen to some cheery chats about grief. If you enjoy the show, you can also follow it on social media. We're on... Sorry, I said social media so weirdly. We are on Twitter and Instagram, is all I'm trying to tell you, at The Griefcast. Or you can email me, thegriefcast@gmail.com. I'm currently in a play about death and cancer, so, you know, it's on brand. And my replies are as such extremely slow, so I'm really sorry if you've emailed me, and I'm really sorry if you haven't had a reply. I am very slowly getting around to them all. Please know I read every single one of your beautiful emails, and if you need just to write it down and send it to me and don't expect to reply, that is equally fine. You can do that. We have two live shows coming up in November. On the 3rd of November at 5 p.m. we are at the BFI's Podstock in London with special guests Emma Freud and Catherine Ryan. Whoop! Tickets are available now from the BFI website or head to the Griefcast Twitter for the link. And on the 16th of November at the Dulwich Picture Gallery, I'll be joined by Jeff Lloyd from Reasons to be Cheerful, Sophie Duker from Channel 4's Riot Girls, and Stevie Martin from the Nobody Panic podcast. Tickets are available from the Dulwich Picture Gallery website, and you get a free shifty at the Ribera exhibition that's on there as well if you buy a ticket for that show. This week I'm talking to journalist and podcaster Julia Rayside. Julia is a writer for The Guardian and is often heard on talk radio and BBC Radio 2 and 4. She's also the host and creator of Always There, the Howard's Way podcast. Julia came in to talk to me about her brother Colin, who died of osteosarcoma cancer, and her dad Jim, who died of PSP just a few months ago. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with journalist and podcaster Julia Rayside. Hello.
Hello.
Hello, hi. Julia. I say podcaster because you are a podcaster, that's right, but I'm so intrigued by your podcast.
I'm niche.
I am niche.
I don't know, death is universal.
But yours is super niche. What's your podcast called?
It's called Always There, the Howard's Way podcast.
The Howard's Way. Now, yeah. I vaguely remember Howard's Way being on. Yeah. But what was Howard's Way?
Well, Howard's Way was, it was started in 1985 and it was on sort of BBC One Sunday evening.
Right.
Kind of that time where you should have done your homework, you might not have done. So it kind of brings back this visceral feeling of childhood Sunday nights, if you're my sort of age, early 40s. And it was a real ratings juggernaut. It was like 12, 13 million people an episode watched it.
Wow.
And it was set on the South Coast, sort of about vaguely middle class people with yachts. So, you know, we can all relate.
See, I know that Sunday Sock because that is when they did Pride and Prejudice.
Yes,
the 1995 P&P adaptation, the best TV adaptation.
Which clearly made an impact on you.
Made a huge impact on me. And all of us in Tatus, we all quote that all the time of like, do you remember that dress that Jennifer Ely had? That's what I'm looking for. Yeah. Remember the curl of that hair? So, like, for us, it's ultimate reference. But I guess I'm a bit too young to remember Howard's Way, but I have conflated Howard's Way with Howard's End. And I thought Howard's Way was a like modern adaptation of Howard's End for ages.
Yeah, on boats.
On boats. And I was really confused. And I was like, why did they do that?
Yeah,
so no. It's nothing to do with Howard's
End.
It's
not experimental in that sense. Okay. No. It was just a kind of, a lot of people say it was an answer to Dynasty in Dallas, the big American imports. It sort of wasn't, though, because it was set on the Solent, which was quite windy and grey a lot of the time.
And I bet that our yachts were, like, not really yachts, were they?
Well, I mean, like, one of the characters was a multi-millionaire and was allowed a pretty exciting-looking, we call it a fuckboat on the podcast, because it's been purely for the purposes of luring women below decks. Ooh. Yeah.
So the podcast, are you going through each episode?
We are. We're doing it like The Wire. And some people come on and they are, you know, very as fond of it as I am, or perhaps not as fond. No one's that fond. But and some people have never seen it. But it's just, it's brilliant, because then I just get to sit there enthusing about the show I love, and while they look confused and sometimes afraid.
Well, there you go. Yeah, because I was really like, I'm glad at least I know what it is now. Is there a death on the show? Do they have death?
The thing is, yes. So the main character in Howard's Way, this made a big impression on me. Obviously, it's sort of relevant to what we're going to talk about, because when I was a kid, sort of nobody I knew really died.
Right.
And then the guy who played Tom Howard, who was the main character in Howard's Way, in series five, while they were filming, he went on a short filming break. This incredibly gorgeous, late 40s, fit-looking man, just had a heart attack and died.
Oh, my God.
And they kind of had to shoot round it, and then they did one more series with no Tom Howard in it, where they'd explained he'd died in the show.
But that basically killed the show, did it? Was he kind of like part of the show?
But also it was the first sort of big celebrity. He was a big celebrity to me. And everyone's like, who? But he was an actor called Morris Colborne, and he died. And I was absolutely floored, because, I'd quite invested in this show by then, and I was probably about 14 or something.
And it's that thing when you're watching stuff that you're so used to being like, okay, the character died, but they're okay.
And
then being like, nope, both dead.
They slightly fudged it in the show. They said he was lost at sea, and then the next series came back. It's like, yeah, he's dead. Oh, well, anyway, moving on. But the whole cast had to carry on filming. Their friend had just died, and they had to pretend nothing had happened. It must have been so weird. It
must have been so strange.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is that, because they could have dealt with that, they could have actually said, let's see them grieving. Let's actually shoot scenes where people are grieving with people who are grieving.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I would have gone there if I was directing.
You're like that.
Guys, let's really get there. Yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah. I think they saved that till they gave them enough time to sort of assimilate it, I think. And then they filmed a funeral scene in the beginning of the last series. Yeah.
Oh, that must have been very painful.
Must have been, yeah.
Well, as we're on the topic.
Speaking of death.
Speaking of, who are we remembering today?
We are remembering Colin Rayside, who was my brother, and Jim Rayside, who's my dad.
And one of these is super recent, right?
Yeah.
So what's the most recent one?
So dad died, he'd been ill for a very long time, but he died about a month and a half ago.
Wow.
I know.
Fresh out of the box.
Fresh into the box.
Well, you are fresh. That's what I say when people turn up and they're still in their first year.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, fresh.
Yeah.
But you have had something happen before. So I guess, so should we go back? So how old were you when your brother died, Colin?
Yeah, so it was sort of 2016, February 2016. So I'm really bad with time. I've listened to this podcast before where people say, right, so time, you're asking for timelines.
Yeah.
It's very pickled in my head. But yeah, he died 2 years ago, so I was 41.
Okay, so 2 years ago. And how did he die? What happened?
He had cancer, but it was one of those, I mean, it's sort of the kind of thing you think, oh God, I hope that never happens to me, because he just had a sore shoulder for ages.
Oh God.
And it just kept getting more and more sore, and he got to the point where he'd seen a couple of GPs. They were, don't know, just, you know, get some physio, take some painkillers. And then after about a year, it was really like keeping him up at night. He just couldn't, you know, function as a normal human, really. And he found there was a bit of a lump on the back of his shoulder as well, and he was like, oh, what's this? But thinking nothing of it. I just remember having a conversation with him on the phone where he said, he just mentioned that he gets up at 1 every morning to take more painkillers. And I was like, seriously, what are you doing? And I didn't think it was cancer, but I thought, that's not a way to live, and you must do something. We kind of had a row about it. And he kind of said, oh, for God's sake, it's not like I'm going to die. da, da, da.
Oh, God.
And then he went to the doctor eventually, and I don't know, someone finally decided to do an X-ray. And then the X-ray showed up a big mass on his bone. And then various other tests were done, and it was bone cancer, but like a cancer called sarcoma, which is
yes, I've heard of
it. I just still don't really understand it. It's supposed to affect the soft tissue, but anyways, it was a bone sarcoma, and basically 20 centimetres of his upper arm bone was cancer because it had had a year to grow and it was quite fast growing.
Jesus.
So it was just a real shock.
And it was just sore. It was just like...
Yeah, basically just the joint was sore. And then presumably because the cancer was sort of adding, it was adding to the bone of his arm into like into his shoulder joint, that started to cause real movement problems. And yeah, it was just incredibly painful, I think.
Oh, my
God. I think because he was a very physically sort of active bloke. He was a firefighter in the RAF.
Wow.
I know. I think he just thought, oh, I've just done something to it.
Yeah, you would think I must have overdone it. I've injured it. I've pulled something.
Exactly.
Just keep taking painkillers.
Yeah.
And that attitude as well is so, of course, utterly reasonable. Like,
yeah.
Oh, it's just that, isn't it? Stop being stupid.
Absolutely. And I think he did go and see, I think, about four different GPs to try, you know, through the course of that year. And, you know, they were obviously, my brother and his wife were very sort of, I don't know if bitter's the word, but sort of really furious that no one at any point said, oh, get an X-ray, you know. It's just... doctors don't have time to sit down and work through all your symptoms with you.
No, and there's just no money. And so if you want an X-ray, it has to be like, well, this better be bad.
And it takes ages to get one. And, you know, because he was just a fit man in his early
40s.
Yeah. You know, in fact, no, when he was in his late 30s then, I suppose. So, you know, you don't look at someone with that sort of profile and say, oh, you know, you're a big risk group for... This is teenage boys usually get this cancer, apparently.
Wow.
It's mostly... sort of, you know, growing bones tend to be where this turns up. And and weirdly, I now know two people who've died of it because it's, I think it's something about social media and being more connected with people. But it is an incredibly rare, like super rare cancer. It's called osteosarcoma. But yeah, not something you're expecting.
Yeah, and that's struck a chord with me because my dad was, you know, running marathons and triathlons.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've talked to my mum about it for like, did nobody? And she was like... He was so fit.
Yeah, exactly.
So she said, you know, she said to me that, so he was diagnosed in February. The November, the year before, 1997, she was saying he'd run a marathon and he'd said, oh, I didn't feel like I could run it properly.
Wow.
And that was the, was the first. And my mum said, oh, well, you haven't been training very well, have you? And he was like, yeah. Apparently he said like, oh, I just felt like I was really slow. I just couldn't get going.
Nuts. Yeah.
And of course, when you're a fit, healthy person, why would you I imagine I have an obscure... Like, yeah,
it's the last thing you'd think.
Yeah, yeah.
I just remember being... my mum actually called me. Colin was quite annoyed because there was always the idea in my family, I think, that, you know, don't tell Julia yet. We'll work out how to tell her. It's like, oh, come on. I've now run a marathon, had a baby, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah,
my parents still slightly saw me as like, oh, let's protect
Are
her.
Are you the baby?
I probably... Yes, and I am by age, yeah. So they always sort of slightly saw me like that. I don't think they do now. Well, my mum's the only one left now, but I don't think she does now. I think she's finally got the idea that, you know...
you can cope.
I can probably handle it. But yeah, so my brother was going to call me to tell me. And then I think my mum thought... She obviously just a knee-jerk reaction. She thought, no, I'll do it. So she called me and sort of said... You know, she's an ex-nurse and she likes to medicalise things and use nurse language. It makes her feel better and, you know, it just sort of is how she handles stuff. And she just said... you know, your brother's seen a doctor. And I said, oh, yeah, I know he was going to. I was really worried about him. And she just said, yeah, she wouldn't say the word cancer.
Yeah.
I think she found it a bit too, like, no, that's not our family. We're not a cancer family. So she just sort of said, yes. And they've worked out that there's actually a problem on the bone. It's a tumour. And I was like, tumour. And actually, the background to this is, a year before that, my best friend had died of cancer.
Wow.
Sarcoma cancer, in fact, but a different kind of... cancer. Yeah. So it was just a real, I think they probably thought, oh, don't like load this on her. She's spent a year going a bit crackers because her friend had died. So yeah, it was absolutely just like another, like seriously. So I didn't really take it on board. I just went, oh, right. Okay. Colin's got, And then I phoned my husband and just said, you'll never believe it. My brother's got bone cancer. And as I heard the words coming out of my mouth, I went, oh my God, here we go again. And it was just,
I think that's why you need to hear the word cancer sometimes.
You do,
I was talking to
Even though it means all kinds of different things, you sort of do,
You sort of need to hear it because your brain needs to process because it's such a strange thing. I was talking to my mum about the weekend. She was saying like that when they gave her and my dad the diagnosis, they kept saying, we found a malignant tumour. My mum kept saying, she's going to die. Well, now we don't. Now, Mrs. Lloyd. And she said they just wouldn't say.
No.
And she said that was one of the worst things because she felt like she needed some...
Yeah.
She felt like they both needed that word.
Yeah.
And then they could have gone, oh, okay. But it was like, now, we just don't know what's going to happen. Yeah. She said he was like, you know, this bow-tied consultant that sort of swanned in.
Yeah.
Look, there's some great consultants out there. I always feel like I'm slagging off doctors. I'm not.
I know, I've met some super, super nice ones, definitely. But they all have their different way of kind of handling this very difficult job. They've got a very hard job. They might be telling you the worst news you've ever heard.
And I think it's interesting, you said your mum's a nurse, so in a way, she, like you said, it's protecting herself as well as you.
Totally.
But in a way, you both need to hear that word.
Yeah, she did that with both Col and Dad, actually. I think just because that's where you go to, I think, you go to your safe place when something really devastating's thrown at you. She just sort of, perhaps sometimes too much, she just became sort of nurse and patient in that relationship. And it was a bit sort of, actually, this is someone you love. It's different now.
Yeah,
you know, you can't hide behind this anymore. But, you know, I totally understand why she did that.
Of course. So then you find out he's got this osteosarcoma.
Yeah.
So then, like, what happened? Did he go for treatment? Was it quick?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much straight away. You know, we assumed because it was so big, like, well, I just thought, well, it's going to have spread.
Yeah.
But they, the first thing they did was like radical surgery.
Wow.
And, you know, this is a very fit, healthy chap of, you know, 30, whatever he was then, 37. His job was entirely physical. You know, he sort of, you know, pulled people off burning planes and things. That was his job. And he went into, it was an orthopaedic hospital in just outside London. So I sort of came along and saw him with his wife. And, you know, just he basically went onto the operating table and I said goodbye to him. And he was like, I don't know if I'm going to wake up with an arm or not. Like, I literally have no idea. So much of this bone is cancer. Like, I don't know how they're going to take it out and leave any. But they did. Like, genuinely, I've never seen anything like it. Obviously, my brother was my mother's son, so very keen to talk about all the viscera of, you know, operating and every operation he had throughout treatment. He was like, can you get someone to film it for me? Like one of the nurses, could you just like take my camera and film it? I'd really like to see like inside my chest and stuff.
Oh my God.
Like, oh, Colin, come on. He was always like that. But yeah, he woke up with essentially just like staples all the way down his arm from his shoulder to his, kind of below his elbow. And they put titanium or something bone in to replace the bone they'd taken. Moved his shoulder joint like an inch lower to somehow accommodate the flesh they had to cut out. They cut out every sort of, because sarcoma can go into soft tissue as well. They had to really clear out the area. And then, if you ever look at the nerve patterns of an arm, it's like they're all just tangled up. It's a mess.
Yeah.
And somehow the surgeons had picked through all of his nerves. So his hand worked, everything worked. It was
it was mind-blowing, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely mind-blowing. And so he kind of had this amazing surgery and sort of recovered from it. And then I think, you know, I think probably must have gone straight in for chemo. He'd had this whole process took over 4 years. So he'd had a lot of medicine by then, which I think we likened in the end to banging the top of a telly. It's like, just give it a whack. Hopefully it'll get rid of it. Might break the telly. But he had sort of a bit of a recovery period. Then obviously he couldn't go back to work because although everything still worked, he the shoulder joint couldn't raise his arm above his head anymore. But physically it was kind of miraculous, and they got rid of all the cancer. They tested him and said, we can't find any, is it metastases anywhere? It hasn't spread anywhere, which we were all kind of, you know, I remember that day kind of knowing he was having the test results. And there was a real pattern of this over the years, just like my husband got so kind of just like despairing a bit, because I would be just absolutely a ball of utter stress knowing today is test day. And one day I remember I had to go to my friend's wedding knowing that at some point that day I'd get a call to see if the cancer had spread to another part of his body. It was just like, oh God, this is no way to live. So he hadn't got any sort of other tumours anywhere. And then I think it was, you know, chemo to make sure. And then we basically thought that was it, because if it hadn't spread, then it hadn't spread.
Yeah,
so he was going to be fine.
So what happened?
I think he had, again, time is a bit fudged. I think it was about a year of just sort of, you know, every 3 months, slightly tense, going for another scan, nothing.
Yeah.
And, you know, he'd gotten through about three or four of these checks with nothing. And then my parents lived down in the Isle of Wight, and me and my sort of husband and son were down on the island for my dad's birthday. And I got a text from his wife, which is sort of quite unusual.
Yeah.
Just saying something really innocuous, like, have you heard from Colin? And I just went, oh, shit, have they had a row or something? Why are they not speaking to each other? not realising sort of what this was. And he was on his motorbike basically coming back from an appointment with his consultant because they'd found something on his lung, which is just like what you don't want to hear.
Yeah.
And then that was the beginning of, you know, I think a lot, without ever saying it, Mum and I don't know about Dad, had definitely thought if this comes back, you know, he's not going to get out of it alive. And I think the minute that sort of news landed, it was like, oh, shit. We'd had like sunny skies for about a year, and then suddenly it was like shit. Yeah, so that was dark times.
So hard, isn't it? Because, like you said, just that process of I'm okay. Like, passing the test.
You don't realise the strain. Yeah. The kind of it's just so relentless.
And when somebody's ill, like you said, that period of your life it's such a huge thing, just constantly. Yeah. And, you know, I think about people who live with illness for years and years and years. It's just,
I know. And how do they do it? I suppose you normalise it.
Yeah.
You just, if it's how you wake up every day.
But get through it. But it is a massive part of your life that you just can't really talk about. Or it sort of has to be compartmentalized, doesn't it?
Because
it's like, well, what can you have to get on, and you have to carry on working and talking to people and look after your child and stuff. But
yeah,
it's massive.
And my brother did, he was, you know, from then on, obviously, was having a lot of treatment, and he'd, you know, found other ways to work to earn money. So when he wasn't sort of him, he was, you know, relentless. The minute he could work again, he'd just be straight back out there trying to do something, anything, you know. And he was trying to start, like, he had all these mental schemes. Like, he's really into sort of, he used to build his own cars and was a mechanic and, you know, understood how all that stuff works. So he kind of got a welder and was like, I'm going to make sculptures and garden furniture and sell them to people. And he was just, everything was, you know, another opportunity to do something with his life because he was just so sick of being sick. And then there were just periods where he just couldn't because he was, you know, really bald and really ill and really sort of with no immune system. And his children and my son, I don't know about his kids, they're a bit older, but I don't think my son remembers either my dad or my brother not being ill, which is just, you know, it's so weird that he only sees them as that.
But, it's strange, isn't it, when you know somebody is so a fuller version of that person.
Yeah.
It's like what most people have with grandparents, because you're like, well, they were ill, but your parents like, no, they were this other person.
Yeah.
So how long was he having treatment for the lung cancer then?
Oh, God, I don't know. I mean, it was, it must have been 18 months, maybe a bit longer than that. And it kind of involved, he'd come to London, he came to London twice, I think, to have sort of lung surgery. And they call it a resection, where they just take the bit of the lung they think that, you know, they can take, so they leave you with as much as possible.
God.
And again, for a really fit guy, suddenly having less capacity to breathe is like a really big thing as well. But he took it all with sort of his usual good humour and, you know, he's so relentless, he refused to like stay in bed. Like after the surgery, he'd be like, right, I'm going for a walk, you know, the minute he came round. And but, you know, as time went on, it became clear we were just chasing this thing around his body. And it did, it stayed in his lungs. I don't think it turned up anywhere else, but it, you know, it sort of, I think it was in one lung only. So they were thinking, well, just take what we were kind of almost saying, can't you just take the lung away? Can we just stop this stressful, like, oh, it's come back. And then obviously I think towards the end it just hit with both lungs. And, you know, I think he got like there was a really, again, this is the way my brother would frame it. It's no big deal, but the life insurance I've got, they pay out if you've been given like a 12-month prognosis. Like, so we've told them that. So, and the doctors are saying that's fine. So we've got our life insurance payout. And I'm like, is this your way of telling me you're dying?
Yeah.
Gosh, that was not how I expected you to do it.
Yeah.
So it was all a bit kind of, you know, I think he didn't really think he was going to die.
It must be just, I mean, how...
I don't know how you process it.
How do you process it?
And when you've got two children and a wife and you just think, well, how am I going to leave these people?
Yeah.
And I don't know how he did it.
How old were his kids?
They were sort of about 8 and 10.
Oh.
Yeah.
I was hoping for a bit older.
Yes, either really, really old or like so young they'll never remember any of it. But no, there was, it's, you know, they had amazing counselling.
That's good.
In their school, someone came in once a week.
Wow.
There was another kid in their class whose mum had died of cancer.
Wow.
And they had a counsellor that came in as soon as the terminal diagnosis came along. So they were able to talk about what was going to happen.
Amazing.
Which is incredible, I think.
Yeah, thank
and
God.
I didn't know that kind of thing went on. And actually, I think, you know, it's still tough for them, but they are much more able to talk about it.
Yeah, and just to have that established that if you want to, you can.
Yeah.
I think that's like, even if they never have counselling again,
yeah.
they have learned it's okay to talk about it.
Yeah.
Which is just basically all that can save you.
Yeah, for sure.
So then he gets sort of sicker and sicker. Did he go into a hospice or...?
Only at the very end. It was kind of all a bit of a scramble because, like I said, you know, if Colin could just carry on as normal, then he would.
Yeah.
So it was, I mean, mercifully, he didn't, you know, he had sort of a bit of oxygen at home. That was when it became a bit, you know, there's a, you know, you can have an oxygen machine to help you raise your oxygen level in your blood. But it's like a tank. It's like this thing.
It looks
in your
really
hallway.
Sort of David Lynch scary.
Yeah, and it looks terrifying and it kind of makes you... It would definitely have made him feel like, oh, shit, no, I don't want that. I don't want this sitting in my house. But he did eventually have that. And, you know, very occasionally he'd start to use that. And then, he just, again, it's hard to remember exactly how it all happened. But he was getting really poorly. It was around his wife's birthday in sort of January 2016. And he insisted he had to take her out for a birthday lunch. But he was, you know, pretty much like an old man by then. We'd found like this, you know, obviously when your family member's dying and there's no hope, you go, though there must be hope. So we'd kind of been looking at drug trials and we'd found one drug that he was eligible to take if we could get the money for it. So we did a crowdfunder. Wow. We raised like £20,000. It was kind of amazing. People were amazing. And we bought him this drug and it did give him about 6 extra months because he was told he was going a lot quicker than that. But it kind of turned his hair white and he was quite sort of bloated and he looked like Father Christmas.
Wow.
I called him, who's the Kentucky Fried Chicken guy?
I called him Colonel Sanders
a lot, which really annoyed him. so he kind of looked a bit like an old man, which is really strange because he was 41. He was young. But it took me a while after he died to remember who had died, if that's not a weird thing to say.
Because
you know how illness can really change someone.
Especially if it changes them so visually.
Yeah.
So then your picture of the healthy person is like...
Yeah.
Where did they go? And I always sort of, well, my brain's like, they're there on holiday.
Yeah.
But that old ill person
the
died.
The old chubby guy.
They died because they were sick.
Yeah.
I don't know where the other healthy person has gone. Yeah.
It's so weird, isn't
you're
it?
Grieving
they're not the same.
It's another loss, basically.
Yeah.
And you haven't sort of, I think especially when there's sickness, obviously if something happens very suddenly and tragically, you don't see it. But when
different.
Someone's sick for years and you see them tail off, it becomes a really strange experience.
It does, yeah. I mean, the same thing happened with my dad, but it was even sort of a longer experience. It was a different experience because he was older. He just died short of his like 80th birthday.
Right,
but
okay.
You know, in your head, your dad's not 80. He's my dad. So, but yeah, so Colin, he took her out for lunch, but plainly was in a bad way.
Yeah.
And she just about managed to get him home. And I think very shortly after that, he was taken into hospital. And, you know, I don't know when I remember a nurse saying to me something about, oh, because it's his body shutting down. And I kind of wanted to go, what?
Yeah,
what are you talking about? Just not, you just don't necessarily accept it when it's right in front of your eyes even. But yeah, he just started to get iller and iller. And he got this sort of, is it edema? Where your kind of legs swell, your arms swell.
Yeah, yeah. It's
when
like
some part of your body is not.
The kidneys or something like that, isn't it?
Something shutting down. So it's sort of, it causes all kinds of other problems. So I think a week before he really got ill, he just said to his mates, because he always used to do this like big sort of open house, everyone come round, we're having a barbecue. He just invited everyone over and it was kind of brilliant. And
so he sort of was there almost for his funeral in a way.
We have to get to that. He was there for his funeral. He was all but propped up in a chair with sunglasses. I mean, he wasn't, but you know, he was very present for that.
So he has this big open house.
Yeah, he was a very, you know, kind of one of those guys. Everyone knew him, everyone liked him. He loved it when the house was full of people, you know, having a beer and getting the barbecue going. He basically wanted to be Australian. That would have been his dream. He invited everyone over. People were kind of becoming aware how sick he was and just went, definitely. And everyone just dropped everything and came over and it was lovely. And the house just filled. And he was just sat on the sofa kind of in pyjamas with an oxygen tube in his nose.
Yeah.
His voice was very raspy. I think something was, it might have been a tumour, I don't know.
Yeah.
By the end, we just didn't know where the cancer was. It wasn't really important.
Yeah, once it's spread, isn't it? It's like, who cares where it is? It's just...
Yeah, exactly. So he couldn't really speak much, but he could kind of, that didn't stop him kind of like, you know, hoarsely whispering at everyone. And it was really nice. And he looked, you know, although he looked really ill, he was kind of really happy to be surrounded by people and for people not to be scared, not to kind of stay away, which people can do sometimes when something so horrible is
frightening.
Going on.
And especially, you said, when someone changes so visually.
Yeah.
I think everyone reverts back to a child of like, I don't want to touch it.
A little bit, exactly. Yeah. It's true. And then I think during that week, his heart rate got incredibly high. So he was kind of admitted to a cardiac unit of his local hospital, which was kind of, I mean, I understand why they did it, but, you know, obviously a hospital and a hospice, the differences are so stark. And he was kind of in this side room. They'd found him a side room at least, which is really nice. And, you know, people were starting to come in and see him. And my dad, he was really, really ill then. And in a nursing home, it was quite, we had to organise basically a carer and my mum and a kind of specially adapted taxi to get him from the Isle of Wight to where my brother was so he could basically say goodbye.
Jesus.
Which was just, I mean, one day I'll kind of, you know, if I was watching this in a film, I'd say this is, I can't, it's too much.
It's like, too much.
It's
the,
a dying
the viewer man can't
cope saying
with
goodbye
it.
To his dying son. This is too much.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is what it is. And that's what happened. And then his wife was really distraught because we just really wanted, she'd promised him, like, you will go to a hospice, I won't let you die in hospital. He didn't want to.
Yeah.
And then for you know, for reasons of their kids and stuff, they said, well, don't bring me home. I don't want them to associate home with dad dying. And so, you know, the hospice was the best bet. But, you know, it's a luck of the draw thing, the hospice. Yeah. You have to wait for a place.
There's not always room. Which
you have to wait for somebody else to die. And it's just
sort
like,
of, I don't think people realise that hospices are, well, they're like charities, some of them. And like, they don't have a lot of funding and they don't have a lot of beds. And
no.
If it's a bad time of year, you might not get in.
It's incredible, isn't it? And you think, well, that's, you know, honestly, you know, your brain goes, well, we'll just take out a loan. What can we buy that will get you? There's nothing. You just have to, you know, take your chances. But luckily, again, the things that you think of as good luck when you get to this stage. But luckily, the palliative care team, who are the ones who, you know, come and give you all the nice drugs and keep you comfortable, they sort of came round and said, you know, I think it was on like a Friday or Saturday maybe, we've got a place at the local hospice.
Oh.
And so he was sort of taken there and we came and met his wife there. Me and my husband sort of went and met her there and sort of, went down. In fact, no, I think she called us. We went down for a bit, then we came home for a bit because we weren't sure what we were dealing with time-wise.
Yeah.
And then the next sort of morning she called and said, come back. So we kind of heard down. It was sort of in the south of England. We were in London, so it wasn't sort of too bad. But
he made it to a hospice then.
He did. I mean, I think he was there for less than a day. And then we got there and some friends arrived as well. My mum was with my dad on the Isle of Wight. She decided it would just, you know, she'd stay with him and we'd sort of...
That is a fucking horrible decision.
Oh, yeah. No, it's the worst.
Oh, my God, your poor mum.
Yeah, I know. I think, again, she's sort of not someone who shows when she's going through tough times. She just sort of... My whole family's RAF, like mum and dad met in the RAF, Colin joined the RAF. Like, they're all very stiff upper lip and on we go and carry on. So she took that decision and then, it was, again, because my brother was like this, his wife, we got to the hospice, we all sat around the bed. I think it was a Saturday night. I think my husband said, if Colin was, you know, I mean, we all talked to him. That was another really important thing hospices do. They talk to your person. They don't just talk about them over their heads. But we sort of said, I reckon, you know, it's Saturday night. There's a gang of people here. Colin would definitely want us to have a drink. So my husband and one of Colin's friends went out to the local supermarket and bought wine glasses and wine and a bottle of whiskey and some snacks. And we basically had a party. I think Donna even sort of said, well, he'd be gutted to miss this and put a little bit of whiskey on his lips. Because, you know, you do funny things when you're...
But also, like, it's too late to worry about the alcohol, isn't it? Like, it's fine. So,
totally.
Get it down.
Completely. Like... But it was really nice. And, you know, hospices are so amazing. I'm sure I've, you know, had so many people say that on this podcast. They are just incredible. And they didn't really have long with Colin, but they just made us feel so comfortable. They put me and my husband up overnight in a spare room. We were all sort of just, I don't know, you get into a holding pattern, I think, when you're waiting for someone to die. So we're all sitting with him in the morning. And then I think someone had to come in to wash him or something. So his wife, Donna, stayed with him and we sort of went out into the garden for a bit. And you always wonder, if I go out into the garden, will he die? Like, I wonder. And he didn't. So we kind of were talking in the garden for a bit and just kind of, you know, wondering what to do and, you know, saying things you think now, God, that's awful. Why did I say that? But like, how long is this going to take?
You just don't know.
Why did I say that?
Yeah. But also I think your brain is literally thinking, well, what
Yeah.
You've never been through this before.
No, someone was looking after my son and, you know, you kind of go practical when you really shouldn't be thinking practically.
And
it's not
about
that.
But it reminds me so much of childbirth.
Yes.
When people are like, well, how long, as a woman, you're like, well, how long is it going to take? And a doctor looks at you, you're like, who knows?
I know.
Who knows how long it's going to take?
I have the best experience of it. I've only had one child and he was, you know, massively overdue, about 10 days overdue. And my mum, I explained the military family thing is strong in this family. And she had already planned to come to London that weekend.
Right, and he's late. So.
Genuinely. And they were coming to a wedding anniversary party. They were staying with my husband's parents, actually, just outside of London. And I explained, I don't really want to be, but they're probably going to induce me. Oh, we'll just get on with it, whatever. And she said, well, look, I've booked the ferry for Sunday at 6:00. So could we try and work around that? And she wasn't joking. Genuinely.
Just pass a message to the baby. We really haven't got time for this. Those ferries are very expensive. Thank you very much.
Recently, I mean, God, it's the funniest times you start laughing, but I've just been trying to organise the little memorial stone for my dad because he had a cremation. And my mum surprised me and sort of said, well, actually, get a stone, have his name engraved on it, but leave a space for me. When it's my time, we can go in there together. And I almost felt like saying, well, look, we have already put the dates on, so I don't want to be funny, but we haven't really got time to... Yeah, no, it's a running family
Yes,
joke.
I needed more, a bigger stone, mother. It's not on the schedule. Yeah, but it's like, of course, in hospices, because you're just looking for anything.
Yeah.
So if you could say, how long will this happen? And someone could tell you, an hour.
Yes,
and you could
as
think,
if anyone
okay,
could.
So in an hour, I'll be sat like, but it's just, you're just... desperate for something to make sense of what's happening doesn't make sense
it's
to
very
you.
Sort of out of body, it's very surreal. Anyway, we sort of we came back in, and I think my husband and my brother's friend, who there, a lot of people had there but been there the night before, but I think some people just felt like they wanted to, you know, just withdraw and let the family sort of have the last sort of moment, the last few hours together. So I think my husband went out to talk to Colin's friend in the car park. I think he wanted to have a fag, and he knew Colin absolutely hated him smoking, obviously, because he'd been through lung cancer. So he was like, oh, I feel really awful, but no, I'm addicted. I have to go and have a fag.
Yeah.
So they were out in the car park, and that's when he started to just, the breathing changed.
Yeah.
And suddenly there was a doctor there. She was very much in the background, but she was just hovering. And I didn't even think, oh, why is she there? I just thought, oh, she's just checking the driver that puts the drugs into him and stuff. And it's really surreal because he was lying there, and I don't know, I think it was a heavy metal T-shirt. It's so weird. It's like, you can't die in that quickly. You have to wear something smocky or, I don't know, like, oh, this is really weird. And his breathing sort of got very, you know, big gaps between the breathing. And I think Donna and I just sort of noticed at the same time, went, oh, like, you don't quite expect, every stage, you don't quite expect this to be it.
You just sort of get used to it as well, don't you? Plateau. You're like, okay, she's in a hospice. This is what we're going to do.
Quite
we're just going to sort of live here.
Almost, you're watching someone breathing.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people say that. You're just sort of watching, and it's very...
You're so present, aren't you? You're so completely present. The rest of the world doesn't exist.
Yeah.
It's like giving birth. It's like everything just goes away and
it's
really far away.
Yeah.
And the same when someone's dying. It's just like, it's just you and that person, their breath, and that's it.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, every meditation teacher in the world, that's all they're ever trying to do to you.
Yeah.
And you're like, I can't do this.
Yeah.
So, was it you and his wife then?
Yeah, just the two of us,
Wow.
And it was, so, I know, I sort of felt very... I was really glad I was there. It's a really strange thing to say, but
no,
I was with my dad as well. And I think you feel really, I don't know, just glad to have been present in some way. Just let them know in that last moment they weren't alone.
Yeah.
But it was just, it felt like a kind of privilege, really. But obviously, you know, that was also, I mean, it was me saying goodbye to my brother. It was a wife saying goodbye to her husband.
Yeah.
So I slightly felt, you know, I don't know, you feel a bit sort of, how involved should I be in this and how close should I be?
It's hard as a sibling. We've talked about this before
on
the show. Like, because obviously I have a brother, and I know that relationship of, like, especially as a younger sister, I sort of am always surprised when I'm not involved in something he's doing. Like, oh, but I'm his sister. And you always have this, like, oh, yeah.
You had a whole life.
Everybody else thinks it's weird that you're... Oh, right.
Yeah.
But you're so used to being part of their world and your world's being so connected.
Yeah.
So, did you... It must have been... Well, I guess that's a testament to your relationship with his wife, that she was happy for you to be there and he, you know, you knew it was okay for you to be there.
Yeah, she was amazing sort of throughout, really. I think in the end she appreciated just the support, having someone there.
I think so.
And, you know, it was sort of... Yeah, it was just a really... It's still really hard to process it because it's such an odd thing to go through. I think... when I was little, you know, I was so, the idea of death is so terrifying.
Yeah.
And I watched a lot of TV and a lot of films, like popular culture informs almost everything I know about life, and not in a helpful way always. And so when you're kind of coming up to the actual reality of it, I think I was expecting, in a very, you know, out of the corner of my eye way, oh, it'll be gothic or dramatic.
But you said he'll be wearing a smock.
Yes, definitely.
And the candles
he
will
won't
appear.
Just be wearing one of his t-shirts. Yeah. That's bizarre. But, you know, it is. It's very...
Well, it's very normal.
It's very normal. Being in the hospice felt really normal.
Yeah.
The way they behaved was so normalising. It was brilliant. And I think it taught me... So when I did it again with Dad, I wasn't afraid of it, or it was a very... I don't know. It felt like a very good thing to be present, seeing and experiencing, because you can't sort of, you can't not die in life, it turns out. I'm so cross to find this out, but
I know,
apparently
me
I'm
too.
Definitely going to as well.
Tell me about it. Yeah. But that's the thing, I think, because it's shoved away and we don't talk about it and we don't, and just because of medicine and life and nutrition, we don't experience it in the same way as we used to. And I think what you're describing there, like, you know, 60, 70 years ago, that you would have seen a death in your, as a child, as a teenager.
And bodies were sort of laid out.
Bodies
and all
were
that
laid
kind of
out.
Stuff.
So when it came to your parents or your brother, you would have been like, yeah, okay, I know what this is.
Yeah.
And we're just so desensitized to it. And like the idea of it not being like, it is the most normal thing possible.
It is. And like you said, birth, death,
but
like
then
the
when,
same.
Yeah, we all are born, we all will die. Yeah. And yet everyone's like, I had to have a baby. This person died. Like, what? Why?
Yeah, I know. Like, we shouldn't not be surprised by this, but we are. You're right.
It's like, you know, is that very... But like you said, I'm similar. I am obsessed with popular culture as growing up. I just watched everything.
Yeah.
And so when it doesn't... Like, I used to have this thing as a kid of, like, I used to walk up the stairs trailing my teddy bear up the stairs like cartoons did.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I thought, well, that's how you walk upstairs.
That's it. Yeah, yeah,
that's what you
copy,
do.
Exactly.
You copy. And I think that's the thing, because a death, to show a normal death would be, you know.
It's quite boring.
It's quite boring. There's something very mundane about it. Like, so people just stop breathing.
Yeah. They slow down and then they stop. It's the most sort of prosaic thing, isn't it?
Yeah. But then but the feelings are not, the feelings of my brother, how I feel, my love, are not mundane and prosaic.
No.
But the process is.
Yeah, and you're trying to put the two together.
Yeah, yeah.
There should be choirs singing. Where are the choirs?
Where are the choirs? Yeah, God. Oh my God, yeah. So it's amazing that you were able to be.
I'm really glad I was there. Yeah.
And obviously must have helped with your dad, that you had done it once before. Like, as awful as it is.
No, it really genuinely did. It meant I was... I think where my mum was sort of, I don't know, I mean, she wasn't, obviously, she wasn't with Colin. I asked her, actually, I said, have you ever seen anyone, obviously, as a nurse, she's seen lots of dead bodies. I said, have you ever seen anyone you love no longer with us? And she was like, oh, no, I haven't. I thought, oh, God, you've got your whole life, like, not experiencing this.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
But she must have seen way more dead bodies
than
you.
I know, loads.
But you've seen your brother and your dad.
Yeah.
And perhaps if that's your day job, perhaps you can't face it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Maybe. As it was too much of a busman's holiday, I won't thank
you. Perhaps if someone said to you, do you want to write this thing for fun? You're like, God, are you going to pay me? Like,
no.
That's my job. Yeah, so perhaps she was just like, I can't marry those two things because that's what I do.
Yeah. Yeah, I think she really struggled with it. So yeah, when my dad died, it was just the two of us.
Wow.
And actually, that was kind of really special.
Yeah.
Which sounds, again, really odd thing to say.
No, I think I completely understand. I mean, it's totally individual. And if you choose not to be there, of course,
whatever
works for you. But
yeah.
I completely understand. Like, I was there when my dad died and I don't regret it. And it didn't even occur to me that I wouldn't be.
No, exactly.
I think my mum said, oh, you know, like, I wanted you and your brother to be there. And I was like, well, yeah, of course. What do you mean?
Where would I be?
Yeah, where would I have been? Yeah. In the next room? How bizarre. Like, at home?
Yeah.
No, like, it felt the most normal thing in the world to be in that room with him.
Because like, you're not being asked to go in and... It's like, again, TV is to blame. You're not being, like, I don't know, taken into a morgue to see the body of a dead person you've never met before. You are watching someone who's completely familiar to you just sort of wind down.
Especially a family member. It's that thing of, like, a brother. Like, you've seen everything of that person.
Sadly,
You know the worst of that person and the best.
Yeah.
And you love them.
Yeah.
That's... You know, so of course, why wouldn't you be?
Yeah.
So then the funeral. I feel like I want to hear about the funeral, Julie.
Oh, it was, I mean, it's, again, both with my brother and my dad, they were definitely both occasions where you come out kind of going, yes, that was them. You know, they were effectively there. I think, I don't know, some people don't think that's important to make it a personal, I don't know, some people just want to get it done.
Yeah.
Like, can we just, it's bad enough we've lost them, can we just say goodbye?
And so it depends on how that person dealt with their death as well, yeah. I think. If it's been very sudden or they weren't cool about dying, like, you know, yeah. like, of course.
Hey, I'm fine with this.
Yeah, yeah, but I guess if you've had that time to process, you know, because he was ill for a long time.
He was, yeah. But I didn't realise, so Cole... you know, he and I talked quite a lot, especially we had probably some of our best chats when he was ill.
Yeah.
Because we were very different. We went in two completely different directions. I kind of, you know, slightly joked at the funeral. I sort of went off to, you know, write for The Guardian and be a sort of lefty mung bean eater. And he became like virtually a redneck. He liked shooting at the range and he liked sort of, you know, having bits of old car out on his drive. And we were just completely different. But he, unbeknownst to me, had gone round to friends and said, I want you to do this at my funeral, I want you to do that at my funeral,
wow.
Which I think took aback quite a few of them. And then he just wrote his funeral. He wrote a speech. He gave a speech at his funeral.
What?
I know, which is kind of nuts.
So who gave the speech?
I'm trying to remember. This is all I can't remember. I think it was one of his friends or it might even have been the celebrant, I think.
He wrote it down.
He wrote a speech.
Julia.
I know, which is nuts and was...
Oh my God, that makes me want to cry because it's just...
I know.
It's so thoughtful.
Because you're doing that knowing...
But it's such a thoughtful thing to do, to go,
yeah.
I want to be part of this and I want to be able to say something to these people and I'm able to process my death enough.
Yeah.
That I can do... That is fucking incredible.
Even if he did it thinking, oh, this, we won't need this, but he must have in some...
Part of him must have known this
exactly.
is going to be read out.
And I didn't know he'd done that until quite, you know, a little while before the funeral. There was like a month gap between him dying and then the funeral. And it was just, you know, it was a piece of theatre, effectively.
Wow.
And I didn't think my brother was that much of a theatrical, but he was really into motorbikes.
Yeah.
And he lived on this housing estate in Hampshire. And so we kind of got into the car, followed his hearse, you know, very slowly through the estate. And we got to the corner. And this is where, I mean, the emotions really kick in. But there were about 20 bikers and they just all revved their engines. We went past and that was like really stirring. There's something weird about these big tough guys being really fucking emotional. It was just, it was so beautiful. And then they kind of just cleared the traffic from between us and the crematorium like we were Prince Charles or something. It was like, this is nuts. But, you know, it was kind of amazing. And then they kind of went on ahead of us and formed this kind of guard of honour outside the crematorium and then just all ruined their back wheels and just smoke just rose up from the ground. It was like a film. It was absolutely incredible.
Oh,
and Colin had said, like, I want smoke, I want you to ruin your back tires, like, really go for it. Like, he designed this all. It was completely mad. And then he chose like all kinds of, it's like typical Colin music, like he loved the Italian Job, so he had the Matt Monro song from that kind of playing as we went in, and some really nice sort of soppy music during the service. And I gave he asked four friends to do eulogies because he's a bit of a big head. I want four different eulogies. And quite near sort of the last minute, his wife said, well, can you do something about his childhood? And I was like, oh God, yeah, I'd love to. Do you think he'd mind? Because he didn't really ask me to, but I'd love to. So I kind of gave I don't know, it's weird. It was like giving a speech at his wedding or something.
Because
you don't know whether to just... I try and write funny sometimes. So you just automatically go to your...
How many jokes should I put in the first paragraph?
I mean, it turns out, you know, I was fine because some of his friends were just being really, like, risque and rude about his, you know, his body. And it was all very, you know, kind of irreverent, which is exactly what he'd have wanted. And then the recessional music, which is, you know, traditionally the kind of, we're all leaving the crematorium now, we're leaving Colin, Crazy Train by Ozzy Osbourne. So, you know, it was brilliant.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, and it was all those things you notice, like it had been a bit rainy. And as we all came outside, the sun came out.
Wow.
There was a rainbow, you know, all that stuff. You think, oh, God, are you doing this? But it was a proper goodbye. And, big party afterwards and stuff. It was is exactly what he would have wanted, because he literally told us
literally,
what he wanted.
Yeah, you don't even have to say it's what he would have wanted.
No,
we definitely know.
He knows.
He made it very clear.
Yeah.
There's something, I mean, this is a weird thing to say as well, but like having been to many funerals, really old people's funerals tend to be quite sad. And obviously everyone they know has died.
Yes.
And then the music's very old, obviously. And it's like there's this sense of age. Super young funerals, worst thing in the world, never got.
Terrible.
Like, no, fucking awful. But I'd say my dad's funeral, like, you still have a lot of friends who are alive.
Yeah.
And the music's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah, like, they have decent taste.
They have decent taste. It's not like no one's sitting there going, I don't even know what this song is.
No,
it's
no,
like,
no. Yeah,
and the ladies went by, you know, something really pre-war or something. And yeah, there's that thing of like, it becomes a party because
yeah,
those people had still had youth on their side.
Yeah, yeah.
And not so much youth that it's just agony, but you know, yeah, not enough age that, yeah, I'm you know, it can be an all right experience, guys.
I mean, he sent us out laughing, which I think yeah, is probably, you know, and there were lots of tears as well that day.
Of
but
course,
he,
of course.
He sent us all out kind of going, oh, for God's sake, Colin.
But like, testament to the man. Like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just think you wanna die as you live.
Yeah.
I think that's what I've learned.
You don't
doing
suddenly
this show
become like, I don't know, a person in a smock.
You don't become the Victorian
choir
old man with the choir. If
no,
you weren't
you
that,
don't.
Then none of that means anything
no,
to you.
Exactly.
And I sort of, it's funny because we talk so much in the show about like the rituals that we've lost and the pain of that. Mm. But actually, one of the positive things of not having to have like an extremely religious funeral, even if
yeah,
you didn't live like that,
yeah,
is
yeah,
now we have this freedom to yeah, express a person in the funeral, which I imagine 50 or 60 years ago you never would have done.
No,
just would have sang some hymns and gone home.
Exactly.
You know?
There's nothing to sort of like sort of to tell you who the guy in the box actually
yeah,
was. It's like, this is just another one of those
yeah,
ceremonies we do with black and
yeah, yeah, and everyone cries and you, that's it. But the fact that he was able to express himself so fully
yeah,
whilst being dead.
It was amazing. It was genuinely
yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's incredible.
It still blows me away to think about it because I didn't know if he'd face it that directly.
Yeah.
And he clearly decided to make it a thing, like a project. Like, I'm going to do this exactly how I want to, which I don't know if I'd have the...
yeah.
If someone told me the same news, I'm not sure that would be my reaction.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
So then your dad was ill anyway.
Yeah, this was actually an overlapping story.
Right,
because
okay,
also, as I explained, he was very poorly already himself.
So
and
what,
came
the,
to see
what,
Colin.
He, what was wrong with your dad?
So he had, it's a condition called PSP, Progressive Supranuclear Palsy.
Wow.
Which again, if you were diagnosed with that now, you'd go, huh?
Yeah,
like,
what?
No idea. It was, well, I sort of, after doing a bit of Googling the day I was told, it's what Dudley Moore died of. And
okay,
it's rare. It's like Parkinson's. There's no cure. There's no treatment.
Wow.
There's no nothing. Like, it's, they need research dollar because they don't have any way to treat this yet.
God.
So it kind of affects your brain a bit like Parkinson's, but it starts differently. With Dad, it was like, I mean, I think he had it for like more than 10 years, to be
yeah,
honest, but just undiagnosed, which I'm quite glad about because knowing you've got that isn't like the greatest
yeah,
gift, really. But he tripped over his feet a lot and he thought like bifocals or something. His glasses were
right,
confusing
yeah,
him about distances and, you know, perception and stuff. And he sort of started to fall over And my mum sort of, you know, he said, oh, I'm just getting a bit, you know, doesn't matter. I'm just a bit embarrassed. And my mum was sort of like, no, something's not quite right here. This is, you know, this is more. And kind of really pushed, again, they live on the Isle of Wight. Their medical care there is, it's overstretched, put it that way. Yeah. The Isle of Wight is like a big floating raft of very old people and not enough hospital care to look after them.
My mum's friend is a hospice nurse on the Isle of Wight. Yeah, she's busy. She's a busy lady.
Completely. But so he eventually went off island to the North Island, as they call it. They came to the mainland.
The mainland,
And they saw, and again, I think it was all kind of slightly played down and a bit under the radar, because we were also, I think it was around the time Colin was told he was dying, and he didn't tell mum and dad for a bit longer and made me not tell them for about a month when they were going, so what's Colin said then? Because what's he doing with the treatment? Because he hasn't told us. I'm like, I don't know. He really has to, you know, he really had to tell them. He did eventually tell them. And I think, I can't, again, timelines are fudged, but I think it was around the time we knew he was terminal. Dad got diagnosed with this.
Wow.
And it was just like, it hardly even touched the side. I was like, really? Yeah. Oh, well, I'm sure it'll be fine anyway. And they, you know, none of us really looked into what it was until, you know,
well,
a few weeks later.
Well, you're trying to process brother, a son, someone much younger dying.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, I think anything, once the word cancer gets involved, it's like,
That trumps everything.
Okay, yeah, it is. It's a trump card, isn't it?
Yeah.
Whereas something about a palsy is like, okay, that doesn't sound like, right, yeah, I'm... we're over here looking at chemo. So.
And I don't think anyone dies of it, but obviously it just complications will arise from it. But it so it affects kind of your balance and your coordination. I think it's the way they diagnose it when they're not sure what a patient might have is something about the perception of when you look down, like there was something his brain couldn't do in judging, sort of looking down and like eating food and stuff. That was quite difficult for him. And that was it's something about the eye movement when you look down. That's how they diagnosed it. So yeah, in the weeks after, I just remember being at a train station, going into sort of work or something, and my mum phoning saying we've been to see a consultant, and Dad's got this. And actually, they did that thing that parents do. They, you know, did the speakerphone calls.
Right.
It was always very frustrating talking to them because something about their microphone meant that when I was talking, they couldn't.
Yeah.
I couldn't hear them. And blah blah blah.
I can't hear you.
Yes. Yeah. So it's always so stressful talking to them anyway. And then so they told me what it was, and then started asking me to look it up. I was like, oh, hang on a second. I don't, like, I know...
When did I become Dr. Rayside?
Like, exactly. Like, I know the internet's a bit tricky for you, but you definitely can use a computer.
Yeah.
Why are you putting this on me? So I think there was definitely a sort of... they were clearly... They knew something was up, but they didn't... The consultant didn't really give them much information.
Right, yeah.
So it was. It became obvious over a period of days and weeks that... You know, I sort of looked it up and looked at the worst case scenario and was like, okay, that's not good.
Yeah.
You know, it attacks. It's something to do with proteins in your brain. It attacks bits of your brain.
God.
And slowly takes away different functions. There are specific functions it usually ends up taking away, but you never know if it will take away that function in you or what order it will go in. So it's like a complete randomizer of symptoms.
It's like a fucking nightmare.
It's genuinely, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. It was really, really horrible. Because mentally you're just going, well, am I still going to be with it when that happens to me? Because I don't really want to know about, you know, it's horrible. So with Dad, it was kind of, I was reading things about, you know, you might not be able to swallow. It's like, so he's going to be what, fed through? How does this work now? It sounded horrific. But with Dad, it was kind of sometimes dementia can be part of it as well. And he was diagnosed with sort of early onset dementia during the time he was being treated for it. Well, not being treated, but sort of being monitored for this illness. But to be honest, I don't think he ever really did get that sort of demented. Is that a word?
Yeah.
He wasn't demented. He sometimes hallucinated because he'd have like an infection or something, and that would make him see.
Yeah.
So usually quite nice hallucinations about he'd see like angels or something, and
nice.
And I'd say, God, tell me about that. That sounds really nice. And he'd kind of get all misty eyed and say, oh, it was lovely. And but most of the time, he was kind of fully with it, and just not, you know, that wasn't really part of his illness. But it sort of slowly took away his balance. So he stopped being able to walk.
Mm.
He walked with a frame for a bit and then eventually just stopped being able to walk at all.
Wow.
So you kind of end up in a wheelchair. It can affect your speech. It can affect your sight, swallowing. It's just you don't know what's going to happen next, basically.
Was he able to go to Colin's funeral?
Yeah, he was. Wow. Luckily, because I think he'd have been devastated not to be there.
Yeah.
They just any kind of effort, exertion at all just absolutely flattened him. He'd had no energy at all. He was still sort of eating and drinking things, but just other than that, he was just getting really thin and was in a wheelchair and just couldn't do anything. So yeah, we got him this sort of adapted car and a carer, and so one trip to see Colin when he was really, really ill, and then yeah, we managed to get him to the funeral, which is brilliant. And I think we even had a whiskey. My dad's Glaswegian, and we had to have. It was very important. We had whiskey at the funeral, at the wake, so we managed to do that, which is brilliant. But yeah, he just sort of. It was a very slow kind of decline.
And then obviously dealing with his son's death as well, like,
yeah, which was awful, like absolutely awful. And I'm a big sort of massively believer in counselling, and I love it. Like, you can tell I can't stop talking about things. Like, I think it's the only way to get through them. And actually my dad was this very sort of bluff Glaswegian who'd joined the RAF and become very stiff upper lip, and, you know, wasn't really in the kind of, you know, it wasn't the type
sharing
of person to talk. yeah, exactly.
How are you feeling?
He talked to me, like, the older he got, and the more we got really close as he got older. And the more we sort of talked, the more he opened up, and was by the time he was a grandfather, he was such a soppy, lovely, soppy sod. He was gorgeous, that he was much more open. But I sort of said, look, I know this is not your thing, but Colin's just died. You're dealing with this. He was about to go into a nursing home because my mum just couldn't.
Of course.
I think she'd just taken on so much over the years. A lot of people do end up staying at home and having carers come in. My mum just shut down and said, I can't. So it was really awful. That was traumatic in itself, because I really wanted him to be at home. Mum didn't want him at home. Dad really wanted to go home. So it was agony, absolute agony.
So hard.
Yeah, it was pretty horrible. Probably one of the worst things about it, really, because I wanted it for him so much, and I knew she couldn't do it. But yeah, so he did actually say, actually, I'd like to talk to a counsellor, and I found him, a brilliant one.
Wow.
And she came and saw him every week, and just, I think it helped loads.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
so
I was so proud of him.
Must have been like
77, 76.
Was that the first time he'd had counselling?
Never in his life before, yeah.
I fucking swear, it's never too late.
It is
never too late to
and
just
I know
have a
it
chat
helped
to
him.
Someone. Yeah.
I know it helped him. It helped him to talk about what was happening to him. It helped him to, because again, I think Mum would be always saying, oh, I don't want to talk about Colin in case it upsets him. It's like, dude, he's sitting in a chair. All he's got to do all day is sit in a chair thinking about how sad he is about his son dying. Like, you should really talk to him.
But your mum probably didn't want to talk about it because her son had died.
Yeah.
So
it was much more about her. But yeah, I think she thought she was protecting Dad. It was great. He obviously, whenever I could get there, I'd talk to him. But he had somebody every week who'd just say,
oh, amazing,
tell me how you feel. And, you know, I think it really helped.
That's incredible that I mean, yeah, it's funny because you paint this picture of like, oh, yeah, no, upper lip and stuff, and you know, very buttoned up.
Yeah.
But then it's funny, I always think that when it's like, well, then how did you come out of that?
I know.
Well, maybe they're not as buttoned up, I guess, in a way, because like your brother, you're describing there, and your dad, it's like there was a part of them that wasn't like that.
Definitely.
That's how you were able to exist.
Counseling's weird like that, though, isn't it? If you've done it as well, you kind of, you know that you have, is it what they say, the stories that you tell, the ideas you solidly have about the people you grew up with, you know everything about them, you know what they're like, and you know, about sort of 6 months of counselling, you're kind of going, so mum's the buttoned up one, dad, you're the soppy, oh, I had no idea, this was completely reversed, and you learn so much more about, you know, the people you love. I'm really glad I did it before everyone started dying, because it helped me to deal with their deaths a lot better.
Oh my God, yeah, definitely. Because as I said, I came to it very late, only because people had died.
Yeah.
I think, I've never thought. I'm always like, once I've died, get your counselling.
Yes.
But actually, yes, do it beforehand, then you can cope with the death better.
And also if stuff comes up, like you might, you know, I sort of didn't sort of do counselling and then just address everything with my parents saying, what was this and what was that? But, you know, if there's something that comes up, by God, you know, try and find it out before it's too late, and then you at least might get to have that conversation. You know?
Yeah, my God, that is like one of the hugest things ever, of like stuff you might need to talk before someone does go.
Yeah, for sure.
And like you said, the conversations you must have had with Colin, like having that time to talk to someone is just got magical, actual magic.
I always think it's like those long illnesses are so awful for the people who are ill, but kind of so kind of useful for the people who are having to say goodbye, because you do get that time. Like, you didn't get enough time to realise that your dad was going and that you were saying goodbye.
No, definitely not.
You know, you if you're allowed it. I used to think that was bollocks, but then actually having gone through it twice, there's no, you know, I can't say, oh, I have no regrets, but there's no big thing that I really needed to say to either of them that I didn't say.
Yeah.
Even though sometimes it's really hard to say stuff because, you know, the very fact of you saying it means you're saying, OK, we both know you're going to die. It's like,
yeah.
Am I allowed to say that? You know, and I don't think I ever directly said it to either of them. But
yeah, it's that sort of the subtext is very clearly.
Yes.
If you were well.
So what is your password just for your computer? Because we need to get the photos. Oh, no, never mind.
Yeah, don't worry about it. Just write it down. It's really important that you write it down for no reason.
Yeah.
It's just cause. One of those things, you know.
That's awful.
God, yeah, the passwords. I'm obsessed with the passwords. Tell people your passwords.
Yes.
Tell people
it's
your
terrible.
Passwords.
Immediately got two folders on our computers at home now with everything.
Just put them on there.
Yeah.
Just put them on there. It's fine. Just hide them. Just tell someone where you've hidden them.
Yeah.
Like if
bury them in the ground if you want, but
please. Just let somebody know. So then your dad, your dad died very recently.
Yeah, he did.
So
yeah.
You know how bad. So it was 2 years after Colin, roughly.
Yeah. So Colin was like February 2016 and dad died June of this year, 2018.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
God. So you've had a fucking shit 2 years.
Fucking shit 4 years. And actually, I mentioned my friend Jerome.
Yeah.
So he had this cancer, but his was very quick, so about 3 months. He'd probably died a year before Colin was diagnosed. And because no one I knew had ever died before Jerome, I went like properly mental.
Yeah.
I ran a marathon.
Wow.
I organised a charity comedy gig, an auction. I raised thousands of pounds for charity. And every time I look at that now, all I think is, I mean, it's great we raised the money, but like, I just went fucking mad.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know what to do.
It's your first grief.
I know. Your first grief
is
nuts.
Like your first love, right?
Yeah, completely.
Like, you know, people say, oh, my first love, I was so crazy.
You go all in.
But luckily, you're normally about 14, 15, so you can be hugely embarrassing and it's fine.
Yeah.
But your first grief, you never forget your first grief.
You don't, do you? No.
Because anything, the first time you really understand, oh shit, we're all going to die.
Not going to see them again, and oh, this is going to happen to me too.
Is that's the turning point. And everything after that, of course, is so hard and so painful, of course. And obviously, depending on the person and the age and all of that stuff. But I think once you've got through one death, everything just looks slightly different.
We're back to childbirth again. It's absolutely that. It's like, the second and third ones are much easier.
They
just pop out like a bar of soap.
apparently. So they say.
Yeah, I'm never doing it again, so I don't care.
Sure, guys, whatever you say. But like that first, and for it to be a friend, so I'm sure when you knew your brother was sick, you kind of know what I know what this is going to look like.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's not like, again, there's no judgment. It's not like it's good or bad. It's
no.
You just know.
Yeah. I think my brother was really pissed off that I didn't run the marathon for him, though. In fact, when my mum phoned me.
Such a brother thing.
No, completely.
That's such a brother sister thing.
I think
thing.
He genuinely bore a grudge because.
I'm sure he did. He's your big brother.
So annoying. Because obviously, I did that. I tried to explain to him that I did that because I went mad.
Yeah,
like,
I was mad.
This time I need to deal with it in a much more, like, whatever's happening, I need to deal with it by looking directly at it, not like running around screaming, waving my arms in the air, wondering why everyone else wasn't running the marathon too.
Yeah.
Like, that wasn't a good way to deal with it. But he did. He called just after Mum called to tell me that he had cancer, and he called not knowing Mum had called, so getting ready for the big announcement. And he just said, "Look, so the long I've got bone cancer." I went, "Well, if you think I'm running the fucking marathon again, you've got another thing coming." He was so taken aback, like, "What? Why aren't you upset?" I was like, "No, I am upset, but I'm just trying to process it my own way." I'm sorry
your
about
sister,
the joke.
Sorry, instantly have to make a joke
yes,
about it.
Yes, exactly.
That's what's happening.
We'll get to the sobbing in a while.
And he must have thought as well, like, I'm going to deliver the big news. Like,
no, he
Mum's
did.
Already got there.
He was so crestfallen. I must have been really hacked off with Mum, like, really cross. It's like, I at least wanted the moment to hear, like, how she felt about it. But yeah.
That's classic brother and sister a textbook. Mum's already told me, so I already know.
And again, it would have been weird if I'd suddenly been really, really nice to him when all we did was kind of basically pull each other's pigtails, you know, so.
Yeah, he would have been weirded out.
Yeah.
So how do you feel, how are you feeling at the moment? Like, are you just feeling like, bleh?
I don't know. Like, obviously, every day is different. Some days kind of massively guilty that I'm happy.
Yeah.
Some days.
But you must, I wonder, maybe this is a very grief class question to ask, but. Is there a relief? Because you've had so much sickness for so long.
Yeah.
You must be feeling that, like, oh, I don't have to go to a hospital or look at drugs and think of all that stuff.
Or
that
just
comes
smell
with
the air in that nursing home, which didn't smell bad, but it's just a smell I've grown to hate.
Of course.
Because it's like, I don't want my dad to be here and I don't want to be here.
Yeah.
And, you know, everything about it is sort of, you know, just negative, really, apart from the people here there who are amazing.
Yeah.
The actual, the coming to the nursing home like, to visit him. Was just such a, oh, not this again, you know.
Yeah.
It was horrible. So, dad died it was in the middle of the night. And it was similar to Colin in a way. I'd sort of been down at the beginning of the week. My mum had called me at like 6 a.m, which, you know, she's not one to raise the alarm or panic. and I was like, okay, we're all coming in the car. We're coming now. I'd planned to go down like maybe 2 days after that anyway. So we just, you know, brought it forward a bit. It was a weekend, so we just all went. And then my husband and my son sort of went back the next day because it was sort of school day and stuff. And I just sort of stayed there for a bit and talked to his nurses. And he was going through some rough times, sort of, you know, end of life stuff, but he was uncomfortable. Yeah. And that, there's one thing I was just like, the second this is in any way a comfort issue or anything, like, you know, where are the drugs? Get me the drugs, get me the doctor. When yeah. he's not having this. And it was sort of very, you know, he always sort of joked that I sort of came stomping into the place telling people what to do. I wasn't that bad, but I know my mum always found it like excruciating if I even questioned someone like him. So could he have like a different drug for this? she'd look at me like, oh my God, don't, you're showing us up.
But good.
You know, but I got him the good drug, yeah. So shut up.
And I think that generation had that really like, don't yeah. just say yes, they're doctors.
And she's a nurse. She was taught to do what she was told. If a doctor said do it, you do it. No,
I am all for. I am exactly the same. Once it's possible, I'm like, what? Why? Mm-hmm. Go through. Like, yeah. I think there is no harm in questioning and shouting.
Not
it's,
at all.
It's too big a thing.
I didn't fall out with anyone. They're all lovely.
Yeah, you can be polite.
But
be polite.
I ask questions.
Not, God, yeah. guys, I sound like a slag off doctor. Doctors are really brilliant people, but
they
occasionally it's okay for you to yeah. question it. And
oh,
to
no,
make
you,
sure you're
I think
happy
you should.
With it. Yeah.
We're also in awe of what they do because it is amazing.
Of course, of course.
And they do things we can't do, but you don't just have to yeah. lie there.
No.
Yeah, they did the decent thing and got him all the drugs. And then I talked to his nurses later on that evening and just sort of said, if you were me, would you stay? I know it's impossible to say. Shall I just stay here? And they, because obviously once you're, they give morphine and things to really just chill the person out and hopefully just, you know, give them a nice sleep. And I said, obviously, you know, before he had this really big dose of morphine, he was taking on a bit of fluid and stuff, things that would sustain you, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, well, once he's, I said, I'm not daft. Like now he's sleeping, you're going to keep him asleep. He won't be drinking or eating anymore. So what do you think? Like, shall I stay? And the nurse just said, look, you saw him when he was awake. I don't think anything's going to happen anytime soon. You live far away. If I were you, go home. We'll call you. And if you get back, you get back. But don't worry. Mm. I was like, no, I really want to be with him. She said, no. And she talked me through it and just said, okay. So I said, fine, I'll go back. So I came back to London, which is a very surreal sort of journey home going. It's all TV and film. When you leave the Isle of Wight, you're on the deck of a ferry watching it get smaller into the distance. You know, and I'm watching the island that my dad is currently alive on, like getting smaller and smaller, just thinking, is this it? Am I not, when I go back here, will he not be here anymore? And it was so just surreal. And then pretty much like the next day, I think I was having some kind of health issue and I'd been to see a doctor that morning and was kind of I freak out whenever I get ill, by the way. Like
of
anything.
Course, because
I'm dying. Every day I'm dying.
Welcome to the death anxiety support group.
It's so great, isn't it? Yeah. The first time I heard someone use those words was on your podcast. I was like, oh, thank God.
I know, same.
Thank you.
Yeah, Lauren Silver's episode. And I was like, oh, right, there's a name for it. I thought it was just what my brain did.
I was just a big cuckoo.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got kind of like a bit of a you know, insect bite time at the moment. Really big insect bite on my leg. I'm like, oh my God, cancer that comes up really fast.
Yeah, anything.
No, it's fine, it's an insect bite. But so I sort of had been to see the doctor that morning, had kind of peeled myself off the ceiling a bit because I was thinking something was really wrong. He said, be quiet, everything's fine. And then, midday, I think I was sitting in Spitalfields Market. My son was at school, my husband's at work. And I was like, oh, I've got a bit of free time. I might just, I'll have lunch. So I went to a Leon or something and got lunch and just sat down and my phone rang and it was the same nurse who'd said go home saying, yeah, maybe come back. And I was like, okay.
Oh God, so, why did you tell me to go?
I know. But no, she was very, she was really good. She did tell me to go, but she didn't say, and it'll definitely be fine and we can predict this. She said, look, you might miss this. It might happen quickly. It might happen. So you shouldn't feel like you should stay here and watch him.
Yeah, it's
because
true.
This could take 10 days.
And so, also, you know, actually, she did a good job because you went home.
Yeah.
You got your health checks and
I
you were calm about that.
Out, yeah.
You had a moment to yourself.
I
and
did.
Then fucking perfect.
It was.
You'd sat down and gone, oh, so you weren't in a stressful situation to take that phone call.
Not at all.
That's funny.
And it kind of obviously the adrenaline slightly kicks in, but I was sort of near home. So I got a train back to my house, which takes like 20 minutes, and called my husband on the way and just said, I think this is it. You need to get Doug from school. Yeah. I'm going. And he's like, yep, fine, absolutely, whatever you need. And I just sort of called my mum and said, look, I've heard from the nursing home. I'm coming. I know Dad's asleep, but my mum's very much she would talk about him sometimes and then catch herself and go, and oh, sorry, at gym. Yes, and remember he was there. But, you know, I just remember someone telling me, like, hearing is the last thing to go. Just please don't talk about them like they're not there. It must be awful if you're lying there and you can hear. So I said, I know this is Doug. Will you just tell him I'm coming? I just wanted him to know.
So I said,
like, don't worry, I'm going to drive carefully. If I miss this, I know it's not a thing.
Yeah.
But I'll try. I'll try and come. And I sort of, it takes about sort of like 4 hours, like on a good day, to get down there because you have to wait for a ferry. And it was all fine. It was all very undramatic. And my mum had told me a story about, so it's really weird. Her parents retired to the Isle of Wight and she had this mad dash down there with both of them when they were sick and when they died. And she was, I was like, seriously, now you're doing it to me. Thanks a lot. You've retired to the fucking Isle of Wight. You know, and I thought, so luckily it was all very undramatic. I didn't have to like beg my way onto a ferry. I just drove on. It was all fine. And I kind of got there and, you know, things were kind of fairly steady. They just saw his breathing speeded up and that's usually a sign something's changing. So, you know.
And was your mum there?
Yeah.
Right.
She was with him. And I got there at about sort of 5 in the evening and about sort of 7:30. It looked again like, okay, maybe nothing's happening tonight. And my mum, I don't know. It might have been that she was worried about actually seeing there and witnessing it, or it might have been that she just genuinely thought nothing was going to happen.
Yeah.
Or a combination of the two. I don't know. You do funny things, I think. But she just said, look, I'm going to go home. So I've had some sleep.
Wow.
And they had offered to put her up there, but she said, nothing's going to happen tonight. It's very nurse-like certainty.
Yeah.
Nothing's going to happen tonight, Julia. And I was like, well, I've just got here. I'm not going to... I haven't booked a hotel. I'll sleep in a chair. So I stayed by him and sort of actually started listening to podcasts because he was snoring really fucking loudly. they even though when someone's obviously in the sort of end of life, they still every 2 hours come in and turn them over so you don't get bed sores and stuff. And it all feels a bit like, well, can you just leave him? But, you know, they had to do it. And someone came in about midnight and did the 2 hourly changing, rolling him onto the other side and, you know, checking the drugs were fine and everything. And I wasn't really sleeping because I was in a chair. But I sort of put my feet up and put a blanket on me and listened to a podcast. And I think I must have slightly started dozing off.
Yeah.
And then I sort of just popped one ear off and thought, oh, he's not snoring anymore. I kind of looked over and he was still breathing, but like not like he was breathing before. And it was just all really quick. And I thought, oh, God, oh, I think he's going. Right. And so it's really, you know, I suppose people are just attuned to it when they work in that sort of environment. But it was a dark room but the doors always open onto the corridor and people sort of quietly walked past. And I just sort of went and stood next to him and just sort of held his hand and looked at him and thought, oh, I think you're... And then someone at that moment walked past and they just saw me and went... And then just people just started coming in and quietly putting a little lamp on in the corner. And yeah, it was minutes, like a couple of minutes. And he was just, asleep and then just sort of stopped breathing. That was it.
Wow.
It's so strange to talk about it. Like, it's a really matter-of-fact thing. Because I know people are like, wow, you're talking about a very personal thing. But it just feels very... It's what we said before. It's very ordinary.
Yeah.
I remember there was a really weird moment that really threw me for a loop when my mum had gone home. He died, like, 1:30 in the morning or something. And around sort of 9 o'clock that night, someone had come round, just a domestic had come round to give something a wipe over. Yeah. And, you know, everyone in that place was just so bloody amazing. Like, they don't get paid enough. They work their socks off. The shifts are so long. There's not enough of them. They're so overstretched, but they're all so kind. They basically adopted my dad as kind of, they were all his daughters, his sisters. They'd hold him. They'd give him a kiss. They'd cuddle him. They were just so lovely with him. But this one cleaner came in who I'd never seen before because I think I'd been there sort of late at night. And just said to me, and I had to say, what? She said, how long's he got?
Oh, my God.
I thought, no, I've misheard you. And I went, I'm sorry, what? She said, how long? How long? I was like, I don't know what you want me to say. I know you're probably just feeling really awkward. You're in the room with someone in a really...
But you work in a nursing home.
It's best not to ask
get
questions.
Some better banter. How
banter,
about...
Your chat is rubbish.
Yeah, it's cold. Oh, it's hot. Like, that covers everything for,
what a
you
weird
know.
Thing to say.
That's so
and
weird.
And obviously, I just sort of froze up. And I said, well, look, Dad can actually hear everything we're saying, so kind of don't really talk in those terms. I don't know what else to say to you. And she's like, oh, right. I was like, I'm speechless.
Oh, my God.
I'm actually speechless because I don't know. Like, one, why do you want to know? Two, I think she just didn't know what to say and something just came out.
Yeah.
And then she was like, nope, no regrets. I'm going to say it again.
I'm committed to it, actually. And I think it's a valid question.
Oh, God, oh it was God. Just so weird. So weird.
God, so that was obviously so recent.
It's really recent, yeah.
So you're just coming out of, like you said, a long time of grief and illness and sickness. And
Well, the funeral was, so Dad's funeral was two No, it was a week and a half, 2 weeks ago.
Oh my God.
Because he, again, this is death these days. The crematorium, like you have to get your slot.
I know, they're so busy.
And so a month, it was a month after Colin died, God. And it was nearly a month after Dad died that, yeah. that we had his funeral.
Yeah, so you are, as we said earlier, fresh out of the box.
Bog's fresh.
don't touch her, she's bog's fresh.
I am, I'm weird. Yeah. I mean, I think I'm quite weird. And sometimes I can talk like this.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you just think, oh, I don't think I can... I haven't had a day where like I can't get out of bed or anything, but you know, some days you do just think, I don't know, it never occurs to me first that it might be the grief.
Yeah.
I think, God, I feel so weird today. What the fuck is wrong with me? Oh, yeah. I've just been to my dad's funeral. Maybe that's why I feel weird.
I never thought it was the grief.
No, you don't, do you? Why is that?
And I think if you keep yourself busy as well, so you're like, oh, I am tired because I did that thing. And,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, I did.
Oh, the sleeping. Yeah. I've been sleeping.
Yeah.
A lot, like day sleeping.
Yeah. Well, that's your body just being like,
yeah.
Why not? Just take it easy.
Completely.
You just can't. You've had too much emotion to process. Yeah. And I do think it's like, as if you've eaten a lot. You know, like when you've had a massive
you're digesting.
And yeah. you think, yeah, you are digesting emotion right yeah. now because you've had. And I bet you there must be all this stuff from Colin that got paused because
oh,
you had
God.
To deal with your dad.
Absolutely.
So now you're coming through those doors almost into this other world where they're both not here.
Yeah.
You're going to start grieving again of like, yeah. oh, right. Now we can actually start processing yeah. a lot of stuff.
It feels like this will take a long time.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, the idea of that isn't necessarily that depressing. It's just the reality of it. Like, I don't think, oh, God, I'm going to be grieving for years, because grief is not what I thought it was anyway.
Yeah.
Grief is yeah. billions of different emotions. It's not just boo-hoo, I'm very sad.
No, not
that,
at
that's
all.
One of many, isn't
yeah.
it? So, yeah, I think it will be a long, long process and things will just keep popping up. But that's grief, isn't it? It
yeah.
takes you by surprise. the cheeky little monkey.
that cheeky monkey grief.
It's yeah.
so, but I'm obsessed with saying on this show, no one would say, like, how old is your child now?
My 9. He just turned 9,
right.
yeah.
No one would ever say to you, Julia, he's 9. Why are you still going on about being his mum?
yeah.
He's 9.
Yeah,
I mean, come on, get over it. Just let him have his own house. No one would say that.
No.
But people would say, well, it's been 9 years, you're still talking about it. And
yes,
I think
true.
The process of becoming a parent, and I know obsessive, you haven't got kids, obviously there's, you can still experience grief
but
exactly the same.
The lightnesses are undeniable.
Yeah,
it's so similar.
It's, but I think with parenting or with children, we're very kind of like, oh, you'll be a parent for life.
Yeah.
You'll always be his sister.
And yeah,
you'll
yeah,
always
yeah.
be his daughter. Like,
yeah.
that doesn't, you, those parts of you don't go away.
Yeah.
And especially... having had that illness and that process,
yeah,
yeah, it's going to be... But I think that's really positive. Like, positive sounds wrong. I think it's healthy
yeah.
that you are able to look at it and go, it's not depressing, but it is what
shit,
I'm going
loads
through.
Loads of therapy.
Yeah.
Every penny was worth it.
It was worth it, guys.
Yeah, and yeah. I know I still see one now. We kind of have a really nice arrangement where, you know, she's been with me through lots of this, definitely, you know, losing Colin and losing Dad. And, you know, we go down to once a month if things are pretty chilled. And it's like, yeah, hi, so my dad's dying. Okay, back you come.
Let's
you
make
know, you're stepping up again. Yeah, yeah,
I
yeah.
think that's really, I always
it's
say
been
that
amazing.
To people.
She
like,
is amazing.
Yeah, you don't.
Hi, Catherine. She listens to this.
Oh, hi, Catherine.
You're really cool.
But, like, I definitely think with therapy, it's not. Because the idea of therapy, if it just stopped, would imply that you were fixed. And as we know from this show and life, you're not fixed.
No.
It doesn't go away. So
no.
it's like, you know, the same as we say about like a car, like occasionally you need to get it MOT'd and
yeah.
you know, occasionally. I think I have to do that every year.
I think you
drive.
Do like every year, like
yeah,
by
yeah.
law.
But like, or like with just maintenance of your, it's like we get our hair cut. Like, you know, we wouldn't be like, Julia, you had your hair cut once.
Yeah,
would
come
you
on.
Please, like that is it now. No more hair cutting
no, no,
for you.
No.
Because we know it makes you feel better and it looks nice and it helps you.
Yeah.
And I think exactly the same with counselling. So it sounds like you're, you know, dealing with it as best you can.
Yeah, basically the takeaway from this is I'm amazing and I'm totally coping.
I think that is.
The first thing your therapist would say was like, would be like, no, you're not coping. If you think you are, you're not coping.
Yeah, but also
but, you know,
coping is
day
as
by
much
day.
Knowing that you're not coping.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, I remember saying that vividly to my husband when he was, after his dad died, and he was like, I feel so awful, and this is awful, and I can't stand up, like, this is awful. And I said,
yeah.
this is coping.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he was like, what?
Yeah, yeah,
so
exactly.
annoyed.
Yeah.
I thought coping would be fun or you'd feel better. I'm like, no,
I'd
no.
I'd look capable and have a briefcase and maybe
no.
a bowler hat.
Coping is shit, but you're standing.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's better than the other bit where you're not standing.
Yeah,
That's it. So
for
you
sure.
are, I think you are coping.
Thanks, man.
Well, Julia, thank you so much for coming to talk to me about Colin and Jim.
It's been a strange pleasure.
Good. I'm glad.
You can follow Julia on Twitter at JNRayside, or you can download Always There, the Howard's Way podcast, from wherever you get your podcasts from. If you enjoy the show, please do rate, review and subscribe on the Apple Podcast app. It very much helps other people find the show and is so, so appreciated. The show was edited by Kate Holland with thanks to Whistledown Studios, and the music was provided by the Glue Ensemble. And remember, you are not alone.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.